You are listening to the Experience Points podcast for the week of September 27, 2023, and today we're yelling at clouds.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the Experience Points podcast. My name is Scott Juster.
And I'm George Alborg.
We are the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net. It is a serious but not humorless conversation about video games. And this week, we're coming up for air. We're still trying to play as many games as we can in this this can't stop, won't stop can season we, that we find ourselves in.
Side chat about that real quick. Mm-hmm. I feel like I've just fucking given up, dude. Like, literally, I'm like, we got an Assassin's Creed coming out in a week. Like, I'll just wait for that, you know?
Yeah. Spider-Man. I mean, I'm never going to play it, but, like, there's an Alan Wake coming out. There's all kinds of... We were just talking about this before we turned on the mics, but Sam has discovered JRPGs, and so, like, there's a Super Mario RPG remake coming out. Like, it's going to be a nutty fall.
We're going to have to do our goaties and gamies in, like, June of next year.
Once we get through all of the backlog.
Yeah.
But anyway, we're playing some more games, but for this week, we're actually going to talk about a few little articles. We'll take a break from games and talk about some of the news things that have caught our eye recently. Bunch of stuff going on, but there's a few things that I guess I'll put this out there right now. I feel sorry for anyone that works at Unity, like the rank and file.
Yes.
Like you have my thoughts and prayers. Thoughts and prayers.
Yeah, it's tough.
It's wild out there right now.
This Unity story. So essentially, Unity changed their licensing terms to charge developers based on the number of installs rather than purchases.
Yep.
Hey, guys. Listen, that's not the way that the world works. And people rightfully got pissed off. The thing that this reminds me of is the Wizards of the Coast debacle, because they changed their terms for people using their, you know, the I forget the term, like the SDK, the bones of D&D and all of that terminology, such that they would charge people exorbitant amounts for it. And there was very violent, loud backlash immediately.
Yeah.
And it was sustained. They tried to apologize once. They said, oh, well, you know, this is work in progress. We're still waiting feedback. Resoundedly, the feedback was go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
And many big RPG publishers said, I am just straight up not going to be using this anymore. I'm not going to be using that no matter what. Even worse, competitors started to create their own package that was open licensed in perpetuity for anyone to use, right?
Like a migration path to get people to another place.
Yeah, and like Wizards has, they've rolled a lot of that back.
Yeah.
Overall, they've apologized, but the cat is out of the bag, right? Like people are aware that that company as a whole cannot be thoroughly trusted in perpetuity because they have shown a willingness to just upend expectations around what is in many people's case livelihood. And that's exactly what happened with Unity. Yeah. And we've seen people already say, it does not matter what Unity does. It doesn't matter if they come back and say, our bad, we're not doing any of that shit.
Yeah.
We're not going to do it anymore. Developers are walking away from Unity as a development tool, period. Because why would they ever risk that degree of price gouging from Unity? And you and I talked about it briefly before we started recording, but like, the absurdity of that model is just kind of flabbergasting, right?
It is, yeah.
And the idea that like an indie developer would be able to like recoup their costs, like it doesn't make any fucking sense, and it seems so disastrous on Unity's part.
Apparently, the kind of half measure walkbacks that they're doing is they're not going to apply this installation runtime fee until the next major release, and that's probably not going to come out until next year at some point in time, which really just
so it gives you plenty of time to find another engine.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, this is how long we have until we need to either release our game or port it.
Yep.
And then, you know, there's still structures in place to charge people the fee, but, you know, they're arguing that, oh, it's only after you make a certain amount of money or you can do a different sort of revenue.
This is what's exactly what Wizards said. It's exactly what Wizards had. Yeah. They said you have to earn X amount of money first.
Yeah.
But again, like, look, you know, we know this very well. The amount of money that you earn is also super fucking fuzzy.
Yeah.
So what does Unity say that you've earned your money back? Like, you're talking about long-term investments, teams, software. Like, are you expected to be looking at their sort of tax bracket to see what they've written off as a loss this past year to structure that? Like, it becomes really challenging to identify how much it will cost you in the end.
Yeah.
And that's one of the biggest problems. It doesn't even matter if at the end of the day, the fees are roughly comparable. If you cannot predict that in a way that allows you to budget accordingly, why risk it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just kind of amazing. I mean, the funny thing is, I actually, to my knowledge, it's not super different from how Unreal does it, which is, you know, hey, we're not going to charge you until you make a certain amount of money. Then you have to pay us royalties, whatever, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, sure.
But the difference is the way that they introduced it and messaged it and set the precedent.
That's fair.
And,
yeah.
You know, and so it's just kind of, it's just a masterclass in how not to roll out a product, manage a community, handle PR, think through a problem in a rational way. I mean, I just feel really bad for the people that work there, because the history of Unity seems like a bunch of people that wanted to make cool software. And now here we are kind of nuking a decade or more of goodwill in the span of a couple weeks. It just sucks.
Sure. Yeah. Morality is low. I'm sure it makes people not confident in their own jobs in the coming days. And inevitably, right? Like, this, again, this is true of Wizards as well. A lot of people at the company, in fact, fuck it, ask any of them. Odds are they would tell you this is a bad idea.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, you gotta, I think they did an IPO. I mean, it's just, it all comes back to money, you know, at the end of the day. And they brought in what's his face from EA, that name, we used to talk about that guy a lot, Rich Tello. We've been doing this so long that we talked about, you know, him during his EA days what did they call it? EA was behind that big scheme where everything had to have like a $10 add-on.
Yeah.
And that was this guy. It was the same guy. So he's just like kind of up to his old tricks again.
Ricky.
Yeah. Just, you know, doing his thing. It's just a real bummer. But I mean, on the bright side,
John Ricciatello also sold stocks prior to the announcement. He's been selling stocks for Unity, but like a little sus.
I mean, yeah, it's not a great look to, you know, cash in a bunch of your equity and then raise the company to the ground.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
But I mean, I think like the, on the bright side, it has introduced me to, I'm not in that world really. And so I don't know about things like, you know, the Godot engine or any of those, these other like smaller ones that are out there. And so, I mean, that's kind of the thing. Like, after something rises from the ashes and like different engines get popular, different game developers choose different things, and it does kind of maybe open the door for some diversification. So hopefully we'll see some of those things in the coming years.
Yeah. Yeah. I think at the end of the day, that one of the most interesting things about the story overall is just like the impacts, the long-term relationship impacts are phenomenally large, because, you know, even if the structure that they've laid out now is better and maybe could have been the best had they announced it as is.
Yeah.
It's just, you get the sense that they're out of touch, that they don't actually know who they're speaking to or who they're designing to. And like, how do you confidently build towards that, you know?
Yeah. It's also just, you have developers out there in the community that are outspoken and highly successful.
Yep.
And my favorite quote was the what someone who worked on Vampire Survivors, they were doing a, like an AMA on Reddit, and someone asked, if you make another game or a sequel or whatever, will you use Unity? And their one line response was, lol, no thank you. And it's like, cool. Like, that was like one of the biggest games that has come out in the past couple of years. The developers on it are literally laughing at you.
yeah, wild.
Oh, man. Okay, well, speaking of not money grabs, the opposite of a money grab, no DLC for Tears of the Kingdom.
Yeah. I'm not terribly surprised. I feel like if I worked on this game for as long and as hard as that team did, I wouldn't want to touch it either.
It's funny, though, because they did do DLC for Breath of the Wild.
And I don't think I played it. Well, walk me through that DLC. What was it?
I actually quite liked the DLC. They did a thing where one of the DLCs was, it was partially a story expansion. And what you did was you kind of did these flashbacks where you did a boss rush, where you fought these different bosses, and then it culminated with another boss that they added brand new. But they would throw you into a scenario fighting the bosses with a certain loadout, a certain set of armor and items, and you'd have to do a boss rush with those items.
Kind of like what they do in some of the temples in Tears of the Kingdom 2, but just a boss rush
version. Yeah. And then another one that I really liked was basically a huge version of Eventide Island. So you went into a shrine and it was like, I don't know, it must have been like 20 different rooms or something like that, where you started with nothing. And it was kind of a roguelike, where like you started with nothing, and then as you descend through the temple, all you have on you is what you find in the temple. And then you can like cook the food that you find or whatever, but you go in as like pure naked Link or whatever, and then you know, and then if you lose, you have to start from the top again.
Yeah.
And there was also a motorcycle or something. I forget which DLC there was like a Hyrulean looking motorcycle that was very strange. But anyway.
You know, like, the way that you describe it, though, now I am actually kind of surprised that they did not do a DLC, or are not committing to a DLC.
Well, and like Nintendo's like DLC crazy right now. I mean, that they had that year plus long Mario Kart campaign with all that DLC that came out.
Yeah.
The Splatoon stuff, you know, has gotten support ongoing. It seems like Nintendo has softened on that stuff a little bit. But I guess, you know, Tears of the Kingdom, you know, really what that speaks to is they're probably
heads down on whatever
is next, you know, and really what's next is another piece of Nintendo hardware, you know, so they're making whatever game is going to go with that.
Yeah, that's probably going to be totally fresh, right? Like not use the same land.
The interviews were saying that they are basically done with this version of Hyrule.
Man.
Which I thought was kind of a funny way of saying it.
Yeah, like are they reforging Hyrule? Like is it going to be a different version of Hyrule? Or it can't be, right? This has to just be like a whole new experience.
If they're not doing DLC, then it makes it seem like, hey, they've said what they needed to say, and then what comes next after this is, yeah. I mean, I don't know, Link in the Yakuza timeline? Like, who knows? Like, what do you do after this?
Yeah. I mean, what's funny is the game is so full.
Yeah.
There's large chunks that could have just been DLC.
Oh, yeah. You know?
I mean, I guess just speaking of, like, not shady business practices, right, where sometimes, I think this is overblown. I think this is actually exceedingly rare, where developers intentionally pull features to put into DLC. I think reality is that shit just isn't fucking done.
Exactly.
But a lot of this stuff could have been a DLC, right? Like, fuck. I mean, almost the whole Underdark could have been DLC in a way.
Actually.
Yeah.
I mean, it would have been funny to, in another world, there would have been two DLC packs, and it would have been the Depths and then the Sky Temples.
Yes, yeah.
You would have started with Hyrule, and then you would have gone underground, then the next DLC would be you go in the air. And instead they were like, let's just do it all at once.
Let's just do it all at once. I mean, I would have wanted to play a Zelda. I still think that would be cool. Like, DLC where you're just experiencing some aspects of her story in the past. That could have been really cool.
They would just do a Kojima move and be like, you're playing a Zelda. but after she turns into a dragon.
Oh, sign me up for that. That's a great idea.
But all you have to do in this game is fly around for 10,000 years or whatever until Link comes back.
I mean, call up Anuma and be like, hey, listen, you need to reconsider.
Hold on. I'm going to say a term to you. Strand games. Okay, you go do do with that what you will.
Another classic experience points tangent. Did you see Kojima's Criterion Collection closet picks?
So I've heard of this, but I don't know. Explain to me what the closet picks are. Sure. Conceptually.
So if people don't know what Criterion is, they are a film publisher and distributor of films, especially DVDs after the fact. And they're known for art house cinema and especially capturing and maintaining old cinema. And they have a video series called Closet Picks where they ask actors, luminaries in the space, directors, writers, whoever, come into their tiny little closet that basically has just a huge collection of Criterion films, and then let those minds pick their favorites and talk about them. It's just a way to get a little bit insight into the minds of these people, right? Like, what are the films that they love, that spoke to them, that inspired their work? And so it was actually genuinely interesting to see Hideo Kojima go into his closet and make a bunch of picks.
Right.
I recommend you watch it because it's kind of fucking hilarious because this dude, I'm kidding. Like, he remains one of the most fascinating people because I expected him to go in there and pick a bunch of super weird movies, right? Yeah. Like, maybe like, I don't know, some Tarkovsky and just like weird stuff that inspired him. Instead, he picks old Japanese films and is essentially spending most of the video begging young people in Japan to watch old movies, specifically old Japanese movies. And he loves it and it's like heartfelt, but he literally is like, I beg you, please watch this movie. Some of them I've seen, by the way. So there's like, Uji or whatever. I forget the names
like
of
Kurosawa
the
stuff or whatever. Like,
I think he does talk about one Kurosawa movie. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's funny, but it sounds like it's kind
of Ubunaba, actually, I think, which sounds really awesome.
Okay. I mean, it almost sounds like it's a, and I don't even mean this in a bad way, but it's kind of like a nostalgia exercise for him. You know, not just like, hey, how weird and arty can it be? But it's like, this is from my childhood.
Yeah, like, we know Kojima loves movies, right? Like, we see him interact on Twitter with like Del Toro and he talks about movies he's seen. But I think for the most part, it's been new movies that I've seen his responses to.
Yeah.
So it is actually genuinely interesting to see him talk about some of these really old sources of inspiration. Actually, I should maybe make a point to just watch some of them. I have seen a couple, but I think it'd be really interesting just to see, like, is he taking anything from these and putting it into his work, you know?
Right.
I guess what was surprising to me is I often think of Kojima as a remarkably Western developer.
Yes.
Or designer.
Yeah.
But when he's in the closet, he picks almost, I think, exclusively Japanese cinema. And I just, you know, there's a part of me that's like, I wish I understood Japanese culture a little bit more and, like, could tap into that. Because I think in many ways he probably is a very, very Japanese designer. You know?
It's like, I expected him to pick all of Norman Reedus movies, but there is no Reedus to be found.
There's got to be some Reedus film in the Criterion Collection.
What's your DLC deal right now? Like, have you there was a time when DLC was kind of all over the place, but I personally can't, off the top of my head, I can't remember what was the last DLC stuff that I've purchased. Do you have something in mind?
Ooh, DLC. That's a very good question.
I feel like some of them are like free updates. That model, you know?
Yeah. Did Miles Morales have DLC? I think Spider-Man. One of the Spider-Mans had DLC. The game that you liked, I remember you talking about the DLC, actually, was, I forget what it's called. It's the woman with like telekinetic powers in an office, like a surreal office environment.
Control.
Didn't you play the DLC for that?
No, I didn't play the DLC for that. Although I did quite like that game. You know what? I played the DLC for the Final Fantasy remake.
Oh, that's right.
It was not good, unfortunately. It kind of bummed me out. But it had Yuffie in it, so that was kind of fun.
There was also the sort of shooter Souls-like that you got really into. Did that have DLC?
The shooter Souls-like, which one was that?
It's a roguelike chick. She's like an astronaut.
Super Metroid.
This is also No, this is no. This is recent. It's super hard. It's like a bullet hell roguelike.
Oh.
You remember video game titles, by the way, way better than I do.
Returnal.
Returnal. I knew it had some stupid name.
Did it have paid DLC or was that just expansions? Because I remember
it might have been free. Yeah,
was a thing where they even did multiplayer on it. I don't know if they charged for it, but like it's funny. Like we're talking about this where, there was a high watermark at some point where we were playing things like Minerva's Den or Lair of the Shadow Broker or. Any of the GTA stuff, you know, like had the Ballad of Gay Tony, like all of that shit. Like there was an era in kind of the early 2010s where not only was it a dominant business model, but there was high quality DLC coming out that was like kind of a must play thing. And I feel like the model has shifted a little bit with all the service game stuff.
Yeah. Well, two notes on that too. One is I think that they're, we do see more, maybe not many, and certainly not as much as I'd like, but like AA entries in that space. Mm. AC Mirage is kind of an example, right? Like that game's coming out soon. It's I think it's $40 or something. Yeah. It's a shorter experience. Miles Morales, right? Like that could have been DLC, but was just kind of its own experience, you know? What is it? The Last Light or First Light? Infamous games. That was a really long time ago, but that could have been a piece of DLC, but was instead kind of its own experience. I love that approach. That is my favorite approach to revisiting a world.
Yeah.
And I'll pay more, right? Like DLC is often $10, $15. Yeah. These games can go from anywhere $20 to $40. Yeah, like I'll pay more to get something that feels like you actually paid your fucking riders and this isn't just like a reskinned horse, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the other note I was actually going to say is that for many people thinking about crafting DLC or even playing DLC, like there's so much competition now in the game space. We were just talking about how hard it is to play the games that are coming out this year. Yeah. Can you confidently even release paid DLC and expect people to flock back to it? I mean, unless you're like Destiny or something, like probably not.
That's a good point. Destiny is still, well, part of Destiny has gone free to play, right? Is Destiny like free to play up to a point and then you start to get on the, but it's not a subscription, right? Like it's actually distinct modules that you buy.
I believe that's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the, it's funny. I haven't heard a lot about Destiny. Have you checked in on Destiny at all recently?
No, not in some time. I know that it's still well loved though. I mean, I think that the last piece of content was really well received, and I know I checked in from like a story perspective because they were bringing back like Cade and stuff, so
that was a big deal when they killed off that character, and so he's Cade has experienced a Superman like rebirth or something.
I have no idea. It might have been like a fucking traveling to the past or some gonzo garbage, you know. I don't play Destiny anymore.
I mean, I think it is a bit surprising because of just how much Nintendo has started to shift its focus onto that, not games as a service, but just games with a longer tail. But I mean, the fact that they just put so much into this game. And also, I guess the other thing that I didn't think about was, I think this was the first time Nintendo charged $70 for a game.
Mm, yeah. You think they feel bad?
Well, I mean, I just think that the pressure to make more revenue because it's sold an amazing amount, and you know, if you increase the price by
$10,
you know, like
which
is fun. I remember when they announced that there was no real justification. It was just kind of like, we think this is the right price for this game.
We think you schmucks will pay whatever we ask.
Yes. There was definitely an undertone of like, what are you going to do? Not buy it.
I think they could have charged more, to be perfectly honest. Like if they charged $80.
I mean, the president of Capcom would agree with you, my friend.
Yeah. Okay. So this is the last story of the day.
Yeah.
Capcom president says game prices are too low.
We're giving these things away.
They just got higher. Am I right? Or am I right?
Like, I mean, yeah. We're this only was the just year of $70 games.
70 is the new 60, baby. You know what? Yeah. Can I have just like a drastic counterpoint? Because when we talked about this when games were becoming 70. Yeah. It's like, look, games are fucking expensive. Makes sense. We've been like artificially deflating the price of games for many, many years.
Yeah.
All of that is still true. At the same time, I disagree, dude. Like, games games are too expensive.
I mean, it is a lot. I also think that, I think it also depends on how far you zoom out, because there were games that were extremely expensive in the console era where the amount of silicon in your console had a direct relationship to how expensive it was. You know, you buy, I don't know, you buy Chrono Trigger when it was new, and like that's a $60 or $70 cartridge versus, you know, whatever the Madden game was, which was, you know, 50 or something. So it's like, it's not that this is unprecedented. It's just that we had such a long run of $59.99 being the established price of a video game.
Yes, yeah, yeah, for sure.
And now here we are kind of shifting things to, I guess it was just more dynamic back in the day. And also those were like 1990s price. I'm consistently shocked by how many video games my parents actually did buy me growing up, because games still cost somewhere between $40 and $70, even in the 90s. And like, that was 1990s dollars, you know, like that was even more expensive now, like, you know, post-inflation and all that shit.
I'm still impressed by how many video games my brother stole for me to play, you know,
because that was grand theft back in the day.
That's the closest we could get to I'm pretty sure he did steal GTA, to be honest, the original one.
I mean, the Housers would probably appreciate that.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, the other two things that I circle back to whenever thinking about this, right, is that much of this discussion and the way that the Capcom president talks about it is the way that a lot of industry execs talk about it, which is to say the production of games is more and more expensive. Yeah. But I don't think that games being expensive is good justification for suggesting we raise the prices across the board, because I think my counterpoint would be make cheaper fucking games.
Right.
Make them shorter, you know, smaller, I don't know, teams, like smaller teams. Like, I think
more
that
of them.
There are other ways around it, right? The other thought that I go back to is just the way that the entertainment landscape has changed over the past even 5 to 10 years, right? We no longer see video games as just competing against video games.
Yeah.
We see them as competing against other media.
Yes.
And the comparison that we often cited when discussing games prices and their value was movie tickets. Like, okay, well, it costs you $15, $20 to go see a movie, and $60 to buy a video game, but a movie, you're only watching it for 90 minutes, and a video game you can play 40 hours in, right? Movies are tanking. Like, no one's going to the movie theater anymore, right? And now the value proposition is different. It's, do I want to pay $15 a month for a service where I can watch dozens and dozens and dozens of hours of content? I can watch an entire fucking season of a television show that released today and finish it by tomorrow, right? Yeah. When we're talking about what is taking up our share of time, I don't think that video games are as competitive as we once thought they were in regards to the amount of time we invest in them. Yeah. So like, that logic doesn't work for me either, right? So on one hand, you have like, okay, well, what is the value to the consumer? And then what is the cost of producing it? And if the cost is for production is significantly higher than the value that you're bringing to the consumer, I think you need to question the fundamentals of the cost of video games in this day and age. Now, isn't to say that there's a lot of good reasons for games being more expensive, like graphically, and you know, there's a lot of great reasons games to, staff needed to maintain those, and you know, the games industry might be risk averse if considering how many games that we make. And so yes, there's a lot of reasons to be expensive, but I gotta believe that as an industry, we don't have to already start jacking up prices to $80 just to satisfy, I think, some other major problems in this space.
I think that's a really good point, because what you're describing is, you're basically just describing a linear solution to a problem where it's like, oh, the problem, the games are more expensive, so we're just going to throw more dollars at the price to recoup that, versus change the model, change the types of releases you do, change the amount of games you put out, all, you know, partner with other companies to jointly produce games, like all of that stuff is a more kind of, it's a more creative way of doing it versus just like, oh, these games, just, we just need to charge more for them. I mean, charging more is like the most linear mathematical, okay, this makes more sense, now we have our profit margins back. But it's also just kind of the, it's the weakest argument for it.
That stuff.
Yeah, that it would be interesting. I would like to see. It goes back to that conversation that we had recently around Baldur's Gate, where the independent game developer was talking about how it's an anomaly, because if most people tried to make a Baldur's Gate 3, their company would just fold. Like, it's such a huge bet.
Yes.
And that's one of the reasons why they are charging so much money for these games, where even if they're successful, they need to make so much money to be profitable that the bet is so big and so risky that you just have to start getting into this spiral. And so instead of pursuing the spiral, step out of it and try something different. I really like that point of the broader leisure time landscape that you described, because it's even something like, it really is time now. Time is the commodity, because I'm sure, like, you know, the people developing Destiny are, if they're smart, they're probably thinking to themselves, how are we going to stop people from just scrolling through TikTok long enough to play this fucking DLC?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, it's literally just a screen, you know, it's like, how do we get their eyes on a different screen?
And so much of the challenge is literally like, boot it up fucking once, like, just please God, install like as Unity is, you know, strive toward, because it's distracting their attention from the other things that are garnering people's attention. And look, honestly, this is one of the challenges I'm having now with all of the games that are coming out, and why I was joking about just folding it in, right? Like, I have a couple of hours at night, I'm fucking tired, and it is so much easier to play Marvel Snap on my phone or bring up League of Legends than it is to like boot into a new game and try to figure out how to make Starfield not suck, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's, and then not only that, the $70 MSRP price gets confounded by the subscription service of traditional big AAA video games anyway. So like the Starfield thing, I'm not going to pay $70 for Starfield. I'm just going to use Game Pass for it.
Well, and this is why the subscription model, I think, is here to stay and so important and impactful in how it's changing the landscape now, right? Because exactly right. Like, there are all of those games where I don't have to do that math. I'm not even fucking playing these Games Pass games, but I'm still a Games Pass subscriber because if I do have the time, it's much easier to just hop in. And I'm even now at a point, too, where I'm like, I really got to buy an Xbox because I want to play on the TV instead of being in my office every day. And it's like, this is... You know, they're keeping me in that loop because it is easy. It is so easy.
Yeah. Well, thanks to our show that we did last weekend, you now know to wait a year or so until you get the new, better Xbox that they're going to put out.
That's true. Exactly. But I mean, I'm exactly the market for that type of experience. Like, it doesn't have a disc drive. Who cares? I don't buy games anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. It's changed it. So it's even the argument of like, games should be $70 is almost kind of missing the point of that in general.
I think so. And I'm excited to see how types of games like AC Mirage or even indie games, right? Like, indie games are now priced around like $17-$20 for smaller indie games that maybe used to be like $10 or whatever. But if those perform well, like, I think there's plenty of evidence to suggest there's enough room in the ecosystem for great games not to cost so fucking much to make and not cost so much to consume, you know?
Well, speaking of great games not costing as much, I need to dive back into Sea of Stars, so we should wrap it up.
Yes, absolutely.
ExperiencePoints@gmail.com is our email address.
And experiencepoints.net is the website. We don't charge anything for this podcast. You're welcome.
we have an install fee, though, so...
We do have an install fee. We're just letting you know now at 700 and something episodes, so sorry about that. Mea culpa. If you want to do us a favor, pay it forward, you can leave us a review wherever you find our podcast.
Cool. All right, everyone. As always, we thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Ciao.